Disc 2.
Chapter 5. Miss Marple awoke early because she always woke early. She was appreciative of her bed, most comfortable. She pattered across to the window and pulled the curtains, admitting a little pallid London daylight. As yet, however, she did not try to dispense with the electric light. A very nice bedroom they had given her, again quite in the tradition of Bertram's. A rose-flowered wallpaper, a large, well-polished mahogany chest of drawers, a dressing-table to correspond. Two upright chairs, one easy chair of a reasonable height from the ground. A connecting door led to a bathroom, which was modern, but which had a tiled wallpaper of roses and so avoided any suggestion of over-frigid hygiene. Miss Marple got back into bed, plumped her pillows up, glanced at her clock, 7:30, picked up the small devotional book that always accompanied her, and read, as usual, the page and a half allotted to the day. Then she picked up her knitting and began to knit. Slowly at first, since her fingers were stiff and rheumatic when she first woke, but very soon her pace grew faster, and her fingers lost their painful stiffness. "Another day," said Miss Marple to herself, greeting the fact with her usual gentle pleasure. "Another day, and who knew what it might bring forth?" She relaxed and abandoned her knitting, letting thoughts pass in an idle stream through her head. Selina Hazy, what a pretty cottage she had had in St. Mary Mead's, and now someone had put that ugly green roof. Muffins, very wasteful in butter, but very good, and fancy serving old-fashioned seed cake. She had never expected, not for a moment, that things would be as much like they used to be, because, after all, time didn't stand still. And to have made it stand still in this way must really have cost a lot of money. Not a bit of plastic in the place. It must pay them, she supposed. The out-of-date returns in due course as the picturesque. Oh, and look how people wanted old-fashioned roses now, and scorned hybrid teas. None of this place seemed real at all. Well, why should it? It was 60 years since she had stayed here. And it didn't seem real to her, because she was now acclimatized in this present year of our Lord. Really, the whole thing opened up a very interesting set of problems. The atmosphere and the people. Miss Marple's fingers pushed her knitting farther away from her. "Pockets," she said aloud. "Pockets, I suppose. And quite difficult to find. Would that account for that curious feeling of uneasiness she had had last night? The feeling that something was wrong? All those elderly people, really very much like those she remembered when she had stayed here 50 years ago. They had been natural then, but they weren't very natural now. Elderly people nowadays weren't like elderly people then. They had that worried, harried look of domestic anxieties with which they are too tired to cope, or they rushed around to committees and tried to appear bustling and competent, or they dyed their hair gentian blue or wore wigs, and their hands were not the hands she remembered, tapering, delicate hands. They were harsh from washing up and detergents. And so, well, so these people didn't look real. But the point was that they were real. Selina Hazy was real. And that rather handsome old military man in the corner was real. She had met him once, although she did not recall his name. And the bishop, dear Robbie, was dead. Miss Marple glanced at her little clock. It was 8:30, time for her breakfast. she examined the instructions given by the hotel. Splendid big print, so that it wasn't necessary to put one's spectacles on. Meals could be ordered through the telephone by asking for room service, or you could press the bell labelled chambermaid. Miss Marple did the latter. Talking to room service always flustered her. The result was excellent. In no time at all, there was a tap on the door, and a highly satisfactory chambermaid appeared. A real chambermaid, looking unreal, wearing a striped lavender print dress and actually a cap. A freshly laundered cap. A smiling, rosy, positively countrified face. Where did they find these people? Miss Marple ordered her breakfast. Tea, poached eggs, fresh rolls. So adept was the chambermaid that she did not even mention cereals or orange juice. 5 minutes later, breakfast came. A comfortable tray with a big pot-bellied teapot, creamy-looking milk, a silver hot water jug, 2 beautifully poached eggs on toast, poached the proper way, not little round hard bullets shaped in tin cups, a good-sized round of butter stamped with a thistle, marmalade, honey, and strawberry jam. Delicious-looking rolls, not the hard kind with papery interiors. They smelt of fresh bread, the most delicious smell in the world. There were also an apple, a pear, and a banana. Miss Marple inserted a knife gingerly, but with confidence. She was not disappointed. Rich, deep yellow yolk oozed out, thick and creamy. Proper eggs. Everything piping hot, a real breakfast. She could have cooked it herself, but she hadn't had to. It was brought to her as if, not as though she were a queen, as though she were a middle-aged lady staying in a good but not unduly expensive hotel. In fact, back to 1909. Miss Marple expressed appreciation to the chambermaid, who replied, smiling, "Oh, yes, madam, the chef is very particular about his breakfasts." Miss Marple studied her appraisingly. Bertram's hotel could certainly produce marvels. A real housemaid. She pinched her left arm surreptitiously. "Have you been here long?" she asked.
"Just over 3 years, madam."
"And before that?"
"I was in an hotel at Eastbourne, very modern and up-to-date, but I prefer an old-fashioned place like this."
Miss Marple took a sip of tea. She found herself humming in a vague way, words fitting themselves to a long-forgotten song. "Oh, where have you been all my life?" The chambermaid was looking slightly startled.
"I was just remembering an old song," twittered Miss Marple apologetically. "It's very popular at one time."
Again she sang softly.
"Oh, where have you been all my life?"
"Perhaps you know it," she asked. The chambermaid looked rather apologetic.
"Too long ago for you," said Miss Marple. "Oh, well, one gets to remembering things in a place like this."
"Yes, madam. A lot of the ladies who stay here feel like that, I think."
"It's partly why they come, I expect," said Miss Marple.
The chambermaid went out. She was obviously used to old ladies who twittered and reminisced. Miss Marple finished her breakfast and got up in a pleasant, leisurely fashion. She had a plan ready made for a delightful morning of shopping. Not too much to overtire herself. Oxford Street today, perhaps, and tomorrow, Knightsbridge. She planned ahead happily. It was about 10 o'clock when she emerged from her room, fully equipped, hat, gloves, umbrella, just in case, though it looked fine, handbag, her smartest shopping bag. The door next door but one on the corridor opened sharply, and someone looked out. It was Bess Sedgwick. She withdrew back into the room and closed the door sharply. Miss Marple wondered as she went down the stairs. She preferred the stairs to the lift first thing in the morning. It limbered her up. Her steps grew slower and slower. She stopped. As Colonel Luscombe strode along the passage from his room, a door at the top of the stairs opened sharply, and Lady Sedgwick spoke to him. "There you are at last. I've been on the lookout for you, waiting to pounce. Where can we go and talk? That is to say, without falling over some old pussy every second."
"Well, really, miss, I'm not quite sure. I think on the mezzanine floor there's a sort of writing room."
"You'd better come in here, quick now, before the chambermaid gets peculiar ideas about us." Rather unwillingly, Colonel Luscombe stepped across the threshold and had the door shut firmly behind him.
"I'd no idea you would be staying here, Bess. I hadn't the faintest idea of it."
"I don't suppose you had.
I mean, I would never have brought Elvira here. I have got Elvira here, you know."
"Yes, I saw her with you last night."
"But I really didn't know that you were here. It seemed such an unlikely place for you."
"I don't see why," said Bess Sedgwick coldly. "It's far and away the most comfortable hotel in London. Why shouldn't I stay here?"
You must understand that I hadn't any idea of... I mean..."
She looked at him and laughed. She was dressed, ready to go out, in a well-cut dark suit and a shirt of bright emerald green. She looked gay and very much alive. Beside her, Colonel Luscombe looked rather old and faded.
"Darling Derek, don't look so worried. I'm not accusing you of trying to stage a mother and daughter sentimental meeting. It's just one of those things that happen, where people meet each other in unsuspected places. But you must get Elvira out of here, Derek. You must get her out of it at once, today."
"Oh, she's going. I mean, I only brought her here just for a couple of nights, do a show, that sort of thing. She's going down to the Melfords tomorrow."
"Poor girl. That'll be boring for her."
Luscombe looked at her with concern.
"Do you think she will be very bored?"
Bess took pity on him. "Probably not after duress in Italy. She might even think it wildly thrilling." Luscombe took his courage in both hands.
"Look here, Bess. I was startled to find you here, but don't you think it's... well, you know... might be meant, in a way. I mean that it might be an opportunity. I don't think you really know how... well, how the girl might feel."
"What are you trying to say, Derek?"
"Well, you are her mother, you know."
"Of course I'm her mother. She's my daughter. And what good has that fact ever been to either of us? Or ever will be?"
"Well, you can't be sure. I think she feels it."
"What gives you that idea?" said Bess Sedgwick sharply.
"Something she said yesterday. She asked where you were, what you were doing."
Bess Sedgwick walked across to the window of the room. She stood there a moment, tapping on the pane.
"You're so nice, Derek," she said. "You have such nice ideas. But they don't work, my poor angel. That's what you've got to say to yourself. They don't work, and they might be dangerous."
"Oh, come now, Bess. Dangerous?"
"Yes, yes, yes. Dangerous. I'm dangerous. I've always been dangerous."
"When I think of some of the things you've done," said Colonel Luscombe.
"That's my own business," said Bess Sedgwick. "Running into danger has become a kind of habit with me. No, I wouldn't say a habit. More an addiction, like a drug. Like that nice little dollop of heroin addicts have to have every so often to make life seem bright-coloured and worth living. Well, that's all right. That's my funeral. Or not, as the case may be. I've never taken drugs, never needed them. Danger has been my drug. But people who live as I do can be a source of harm to others. Now, don't be an obstinate old fool, Derek. You keep that girl well away from me. I can do her no good, only harm. If possible, don't even let her know I was staying in the same hotel. Ring up the Melfords and take her down there today. Make some excuse about a sudden emergency. Colonel Luscombe hesitated, pulling his moustache.
I think you're making a mistake, Beth,
he sighed.
She asked where you were. I told her you were abroad.
Well, I shall be in another 12 hours, so that all fits very nicely. She came up to him, kissed him on the point of his chin, turned him smartly around as though they were about to play blind man's buff, opened the door, gave him a gentle little propelling shove out of it. As the door shut behind him, Colonel Luscombe noticed an old lady turning the corner from the stairs. She was muttering to herself as she looked into her handbag.
Dear me, I suppose I must have left it in my room. Oh, dear.
She passed Colonel Luscombe without paying much attention to him, apparently. But as he went on down the stairs, Miss Marple paused by her room door and directed a piercing glance after him. Then she looked towards Bess Sedgwick's door.
So that's who she was waiting for, said Miss Marple to herself. I wonder why.
Canon Pennyfather, fortified by breakfast, wandered across the lounge, remembered to leave his key at the desk, pushed his way through the swinging doors, and was neatly inserted into a taxi by the Irish commissionaire who existed for this purpose.
Where to, sir?
Oh, dear, said Canon Pennyfather in sudden dismay.
Now, let me see.
Where was I going? The traffic in Pond Street was held up for some minutes whilst Canon Pennyfather and the commissionaire debated this knotty point. Finally, Canon Pennyfather had a brainwave, and the taxi was directed to go to the British Museum. The commissionaire was left on the pavement with a broad grin on his face. And since no other exit seemed to be taking place, he strolled a little way along the façade of the hotel, whistling an old tune in a muted manner. One of the windows on the ground floor of Bertram's was flung up, but the commissioner did not even turn his head until a voice spoke unexpectedly through the open window.
"So this is where you've landed up, Mickey. What on earth brought you to this place?"
He swung round, startled, and stared. Lady Sedgwick thrust her head through the open window.
"Don't you know me?" she demanded.
A sudden gleam of recognition came across the man's face.
"Why, if it isn't little Bessie now, fancy that, after all these years. Little Bessie."
"Nobody but you ever called me Bessie. It's a revolting name.
What have you been doing all these years?"
"This and that," said Mickey with some reserve. "I've not been in the news like you have. I've read of your doings in the paper time and again."
Bess Sedgwick laughed. "Anyway, I've worn better than you have," she said. "You drink too much. You always did."
"You've worn well because you've always been in the money.
Money wouldn't have done you any good. You'd have drunk even more and gone to the dogs completely."
"Oh, yes, you would.
What brought you here? That's what I want to know. How did you ever get taken on at this place?"
"I wanted a job. I had these..." His hand flicked over the row of medals.
"Yes, I see." She was thoughtful. "All genuine, too, aren't they?"
"Sure they're genuine. Why shouldn't they be?"
"Oh, I believe you. You always had courage. You've always been a good fighter."
"Yes, the army suited you. I'm sure of that."
"The army's all right in a time of war, but it's no good in peacetime."
"So you took to this stuff?"
"I hadn't the least idea..."
She stopped.
"He hadn't the least idea what, Bessie?"
"Nothing. It's queer seeing you again after all these years."
"I haven't forgotten," said the man. "I've never forgotten you, little Bessie."
"Ah, a lovely girl you are. A lovely slip of a girl."
"Damn fool of a girl, that's what I was," said Lady Sedgwick. "Oh, that's true now. You haven't much sense. If you had, you wouldn't have taken up with me. What hand you had for a horse. Do you remember that mare? What was her name now? Molly O'Flynn? Ah, she was a wicked devil, that one was." "You were the only one that could ride her," said Lady Sedgwick. "She'd have had me off if she could. When she found she couldn't, she gave in. Ah, she was a beauty now. But talking of sitting a horse, there wasn't a lady in those parts better than you. A lovely seat you had, lovely hands. Never any fear in you, not for a minute. And it's been the same ever since, so I judge. Airplanes, racing cars." Bess Sedgwick laughed. "I must get on with my letters." She drew back from the window. Mickey leaned over the railing. "I've not forgotten Ballygowlan," he said with meaning. "Sometimes I thought of writing to you."
"And what do you mean by that, Mick Gorman?"
"I was just saying as I haven't forgotten anything. I was just reminding you, like." Bess Sedgwick's voice still held its harsh note.
"If you mean what I think you mean, I'll give you a piece of advice. Any trouble from you, and I'd shoot you as easily as I'd shoot a rat. I've shot men before, in foreign parts maybe, foreign parts or here. It's all the same to me."
"Ah, good Lord, no. And I believe you would do just that." His voice held admiration. In Ballygowlan, she cut in, "they paid you to keep your mouth shut, and paid you well. You took the money. You'll get no more from me, so don't think it."
"It would be a nice romantic story for the Sunday papers."
"You heard what I said." "Ha ha," he laughed. "I'm not serious. I was just joking. I'd never do anything to hurt my little Bessie. I'll keep my mouth shut."
"Mind you do," said Lady Sedgwick. She shut down the window. Staring down at the desk in front of her, she looked at her unfinished letter on the blotting paper. She picked it up, looked at it, crumpled it into a ball and slung it into the waste paper basket. Then abruptly she got up from her seat and walked out of the room. She did not even cast a glance around her before she went. The smaller writing rooms at Bertram's often had an appearance of being empty, even when they were not. Two well-appointed desks stood in the windows. There was a table on the right that held a few magazines. On the left were two very high-backed armchairs turned towards the fire. These were favourite spots in the afternoon for elderly military or naval gentlemen to ensconce themselves and fall happily asleep until tea-time. Anyone coming in to write a letter did not usually even notice them. The chairs were not so much in demand during the morning. As it happened, however, they were, on this particular morning, both occupied. An old lady was in one, and a young girl in the other. The young girl rose to her feet. She stood a moment, looking uncertainly towards the door through which Lady Sedgwick had passed out. Then she moved slowly towards it. Elvira Blake's face was deadly pale. It was another 5 minutes before the old lady moved. Then Miss Marple decided that the little rest which she always took after dressing and coming downstairs had lasted quite long enough. It was time to go out and enjoy the pleasures of London. She might walk as far as Piccadilly and take a No. 9 bus to High Street, Kensington, or she might walk along to Bond Street and take a 25 bus to Marshall and Snelgrove's, or she might take a 25 the other way, which, as far as she remembered, would land her up at the Army and Navy stores. Passing through the swing doors, she was still savouring these delights in her mind.
the Irish commissionaire back on duty made up her mind for her.
"You'll be wanting a taxi, ma'am," he said with firmness.
"I don't think I do," said Miss Marple. "I think there's a 25 bus I could take quite near here, or a 2 from Park Lane."
"You'll not be wanting a bus," said the commissionaire firmly. "It's very dangerous springing on a bus when you're getting on in life. The way they start and stop and go on again, jerk you off your feet, they do. No heart at all, these fellas nowadays. I'll whistle you along a taxi, and you'll go to wherever you want to, like a queen."
Miss Marple considered and fell. "Very well, then," she said. "Perhaps I had better have a taxi."
The commissionaire had no need even to whistle. He merely clicked his thumb, and a taxi appeared like magic. Miss Marple was helped into it with every possible care, and decided on the spur of the moment to go to Robinson and Cleaver's and look at their splendid offer of real linen sheets. She sat happily in her taxi, feeling indeed, as the commissioner had promised her, just like a queen. Her mind was filled with pleasurable anticipation of linen sheets, linen pillowcases, and proper glass and kitchen cloths, without pictures of bananas, figs, or performing dogs and other pictorial distractions to annoy you when you were washing up. Lady Sedgwick came up to the reception desk. "Mr. Humphrey's in his office." "Yes, Lady Sedgwick." Miss Gorringe looked startled. Lady Sedgwick passed behind the desk, tapped on the door, and went in without waiting for any response. Mr. Humphreys looked up, startled. "What? Who engaged that man, Michael Gorman?" Mr. Humphreys spluttered a little. "Parfitt left. He had a car accident a month ago. We had to replace him quickly. This man seemed all right. References okay. Ex-army. Quite good record. Not very bright, perhaps, but that's all the better sometimes. You don't know anything against him, do you?"
"Enough not to want him here." "If you insist," Humphrey said slowly, "we'll give him his notice."
"No," said Lady Sedgwick slowly. "No. It's too late for that." "Never mind."
Chapter 6.
"Elvira!"
"Hello, Bridget." The Honourable Elvira Blake pushed her way through the front door of 180 Onslow Square, which her friend Bridget had rushed down to open for her, having been watching through the window.
"Let's go upstairs," said Elvira.
"Yes, we'd better. Otherwise we'll get entangled by Mummy."
The two girls rushed up the stairs, thereby circumventing Bridget's mother, who came out onto the landing from her own bedroom just too late.
"You really are lucky not to have a mother," said Bridget, rather breathlessly, as she took her friend into her bedroom and shut the door firmly. "I mean, well, Mummy's quite a pet and all that, but the questions she asks, morning, noon and night, where are you going and who have you met, and are they the cousins of somebody else of the same name in Yorkshire? I mean, the futility of it all."
"I suppose they have nothing else to think about," said Elvira vaguely.
"Look here, Bridget. There's something terribly important I've got to do, and you've got to help me."
"Well, I will if I can."
"What is it? A man?"
"No, it isn't, as a matter of fact."
Bridget looked disappointed. "I've got to get away to Ireland for 24 hours, or perhaps longer, and you've got to cover up for me."
"To Ireland? Why?"
"I can't tell you all about it now. There's no time. I've got to meet my guardian, Colonel Luscombe, at Prunier's for lunch at 1:30.
"What have you done with the carpenter?"
"Gave her the slip in Debenhams," Bridget giggled.
"And after lunch they're taking me down to the Melfords. I'm going to live with them until I'm 21.
"How ghastly!"
"I expect I shall manage. Cousin Mildred is fearfully easy to deceive.
It's all arranged. I'm to come up for classes and things. There's a place called World of Today. They take you to lectures and to museums and to picture galleries and the House of Lords and all that. The whole point is that nobody will know whether you're where you ought to be or not. We'll manage lots of things."
I expect we will, Bridget giggled. We managed in Italy, didn't we? Old Macaroni thought she was so strict. Little did she know what we got up to when we tried. Both girls laughed in the pleasant consciousness of successful wickedness. Still, it did need a lot of planning, said Elvira. And some splendid lying, said Bridget. Have you ever heard from Guido? Oh, yes. He wrote me a long letter signed Ginevra, as though he was a girlfriend. But I do wish you'd stop talking so much, Bridget. We've got a lot to do and only about an hour and a half to do it in. Now, first of all, just listen. I'm coming up tomorrow for an appointment with a dentist. Well, that's easy. I can put it off by telephone, or you can from here. Then, about midday, you can ring up the Melfords, pretending to be your mother, and explain that the dentist wants to see me again the next day, and so I'm staying over with you here. Well, that ought to go down all right. They'll say how very kind and gush. But supposing you're not back the next day? Then you'll have to do some more ringing up. Bridget looked doubtful. That we'll have lots of time to think up something before then, said Elvira impatiently. What's worrying me now is money. You haven't got any, I suppose. Elvira spoke without much hope. Well, only about £2. Oh, that's no good. I've got to buy my air ticket. I've looked up the flights. It only takes about 2 hours. A lot depends upon how long it takes me when I get there. Can't you tell me what you're going to do? No, I can't. But it's terribly, terribly important. Elvira's voice was so different that Bridget looked at her in some surprise. Is anything really the matter, Elvira? Yes, it is. Is it something nobody's got to know about? Yes, that's the sort of thing. It's frightfully, frightfully secret. I've got to find out if something is really true or not. Oh, it's a bore about the money. What's maddening is that I'm really quite rich. My guardian told me so. But all they give me is a measly dress allowance. And that seems to go as soon as I get it. Wouldn't your guardian, Colonel Thingamabob, lend you some money? Oh, that wouldn't do at all. He'd ask a lot of questions and want to know what I wanted it for. Oh, dear, I suppose he would. I can't think why everybody wants to ask so many questions. Do you know that if somebody rings me up, Mummy has to ask who it is? And it really is no business of hers. Elvira agreed, but her mind was on another tack. Have you ever pawned anything, Bridget? Never. I don't think I'd know how to. It's quite easy, I believe, said Elvira. You go to the sort of jeweller who has three balls over the door, isn't that right? I don't think I've got anything that would be any good taken to a pawnbroker, said Bridget. Hasn't your mother got some jewellery somewhere? I don't think we'd better ask her to help. No, perhaps not. But we could pinch something, perhaps. Oh, I don't think we could do that, said Bridget. No? Well, perhaps you're right. I bet she wouldn't notice. We could get it back before she missed it. I know. We'll go to Mr. Bollard. Who's Mr. Bollard? Oh, he's a sort of family jeweller. I take my watch there always to have it mended. He's known me ever since I was 6. Come on, Bridget. We'll go there right away. We'll just have time. We'd better go out the back way, said Bridget, and then Mummy won't ask us where we're going. Outside the old established business of Bollard and Whiteley in Bond Street, the two girls made their final arrangements. Are you sure you understand, Bridget? I think so, said Bridget in a far from happy voice. First, said Elvira, we synchronise our watches. Bridget brightened up a little. This familiar literary phrase had a heartening effect. They solemnly synchronised their watches, Bridget adjusting hers by 1 minute. 0 hour will be 25 past exactly, said Elvira. That will give me plenty of time. Perhaps even more than I need, but it's better that way about. But supposing, began Bridget. Supposing what? Asked Elvira. Well, I mean, supposing I really got run over. Of course you won't get run over, said Elvira. You know how nippy you are on your feet, and all London traffic is used to pulling up suddenly. It'll be all right. Bridget looked far from convinced. You won't let me down, Bridget, will you? All right, said Bridget. I won't let you down. Good, said Elvira.
Bridget crossed to the other side of Bond Street, and Elvira pushed open the doors of Messrs. Bollard and Whiteley, old-established jewellers and watchmakers. Inside, there was a beautiful and hushed atmosphere. A frock-coated nobleman came forward and asked Elvira what he could do for her. "Could I see Mr. Bollard?"
"Mr. Bollard. What name shall I say?"
"Miss Elvira Blake." The nobleman disappeared, and Elvira drifted to a counter where, below plate glass, brooches, rings and bracelets showed off their jewelled proportions against suitable shades of velvet. In a very few moments, Mr. Bollard made his appearance. He was the senior partner of the firm, an elderly man of 60-odd. He greeted Elvira with warm friendliness.
"Ah, Miss Blake, so you are in London. It's a great pleasure to see you. Now, what can I do for you?"
Elvira produced a dainty little evening wristwatch. "This watch doesn't go properly," said Elvira. "Could you do something to it?"
"Oh, yes, of course. There's no difficulty about that." Mr. Bollard took it from her. "What address shall I send it to?"
Elvira gave the address. "And there's another thing," she said. "My guardian, Colonel Luscombe, you know."
"Yes, yes, of course."
"He asked me what I'd like for a Christmas present," said Elvira. "He suggested I should come in here and look at some different things. He said, would I like him to come with me? And I said I'd rather come along first, because I always think it's rather embarrassing, don't you? I mean, prices and all that."
"Well, that's certainly one aspect," said Mr. Bollard, beaming in an avuncular manner. "Now, what had you in mind, Miss Blake? A brooch?
Bracelet? Ring?" "I think, really, brooches are more useful," said Elvira. "But I wonder, could I look at a lot of things?" She looked up at him appealingly. He smiled sympathetically.
"Of course, of course. No pleasure at all if one has to make up one's mind too quickly, is it?"
The next 5 or 6 minutes were spent very agreeably. Nothing was too much trouble for Mr. Bollard. He fetched things from one case and another. Brooches and bracelets piled up on the piece of velvet spread in front of Elvira. Occasionally she turned aside to look at herself in a mirror, trying the effect of a brooch or a pendant. Finally, rather uncertainly, a pretty little bangle, a small diamond wristwatch, and 2 brooches were laid aside.
"We'll make a note of these," said Mr. Bollard, "and then when Colonel Luscombe is in London next, perhaps he'll come in and see what he decides himself he'd like to give you."
"I think that way will be very nice," said Elvira. "Then he'll feel more that he's chosen my present himself, won't he?" Her limpid blue gaze was raised to the jeweller's face. That same blue gaze had registered a moment earlier that the time was now exactly 25 minutes past the hour. Outside, there was the squealing of brakes and a girl's loud scream. Inevitably, the eyes of everyone in the shop turned towards the windows of the shop giving on Bond Street. The movement of Elvira's hand on the counter in front of her, and then to the pocket of her neat tailor-made coat and skirt, was so rapid and unobtrusive as to be almost unnoticeable, even if anybody had been looking.
"Cha-cha," said Mr. Bollard, turning back from where he had been peering out into the street. "Very nearly an accident. Silly girl, rushing across the road like that."
Elvira was already moving towards the door. She looked at her wristwatch and uttered an exclamation. "Oh, dear! I've been far too long in here. I shall miss my train back to the country. Thank you so much, Mr. Bollard. And you won't forget which the 4 things are, will you?" In another minute, she was out of the door. Turning rapidly to the left, and then to the left again, she stopped in the arcade of a shoe shop until Bridget, rather breathless, rejoined her.
"Oh," said Bridget, "I was terrified. I thought I was going to be killed. And I'd torn a hole in my stocking, too."
"Never mind," said Elvira, and walked her friend rapidly along the street and round yet another corner to the right. "Come on.
Was it all right?
Elvira's hand slipped into her pocket and out again, showing the diamond and sapphire bracelet in her palm.
Oh, Elvira, how you dared!
Now, Bridget, you've got to get along to that pawn shop we marked down. Go in and see how much you can get for this. Ask for 100.
Do you think... Supposing they say... I mean, it might be on a list of stolen things.
Don't be silly. How could it be on a list so soon? They haven't even noticed it's gone yet.
But, Elvira, when they do notice it's gone, they'll think... Perhaps they'll know that you must have taken it.
They might think so, if they discover it soon.
Well, then they'll go to the police and...
She stopped as Elvira shook her head slowly, her pale yellow hair swinging to and fro, and a faint enigmatic smile curving up the corners of her mouth. They won't go to the police, Bridget. Certainly not if they think I took it.
Why? You mean...
As I told you, I'm going to have a lot of money when I'm 21. I shall be able to buy lots of jewels from them. They won't make a scandal. Go on and get the money, quick. Then go to Aer Lingus and book the ticket. I must take a taxi to Prunier's. I'm already 10 minutes late. I'll be with you tomorrow morning by 10:30.
Oh, Elvira, I wish you wouldn't take such frightful risks, moaned Bridget.
But Elvira had hailed a taxi. Miss Marple had a very enjoyable time at Robinson and Cleaver's. Besides purchasing expensive but delicious sheets, she loved linen sheets with their texture and their coolness. She also indulged in a purchase of good quality red-bordered glass cloth. Really the difficulty in getting proper glass cloths nowadays. Instead, you were offered things that might as well have been ornamental tablecloths, decorated with radishes or lobsters or the Tour Eiffel or Trafalgar Square, or else littered with lemons and oranges. Having given her address in St. Mary Mead, Miss Marple found a convenient bus which took her to the Army and Navy stores. The Army and Navy stores had been a haunt of Miss Marple's aunt in days long gone. It was not, of course, quite the same nowadays. Miss Marple cast her thoughts back to Aunt Helen seeking out her own special man in the grocery department, settling herself comfortably in a chair, wearing a bonnet and what she always called her black poplin mantle. Then there would ensue a long hour with nobody in a hurry, and Aunt Helen thinking of every conceivable grocery that could be purchased and stored up for future use. Christmas was provided for, and there was even a far-off look towards Easter. The young Jane had fidgeted somewhat and had been told to go and look at the glass department by way of amusement. Having finished her purchases, Aunt Helen would then proceed to lengthy inquiries about her chosen shop assistant's mother, wife, second boy, and crippled sister-in-law. Having had a thoroughly pleasant morning, Aunt Helen would say in the playful manner of those times, "And how would a little girl feel about some luncheon?" Whereupon they went up in the lift to the fourth floor and had luncheon, which always finished with a strawberry ice. After that, they bought 1/2 pound of coffee chocolate creams and went to a matinee in a four-wheeler. Of course, the Army and Navy stores had had a good many facelifts since those days. In fact, it was now quite unrecognisable from the old times. It was gayer and much brighter. Miss Marple, though throwing a kindly and indulgent smile at the past, did not object to the amenities of the present. There was still a restaurant, and there she repaired to order her lunch. As she was looking carefully down the menu and deciding what to have, she looked across the room and her eyebrows went up a little. How extraordinary coincidence was! Here was a woman she had never seen till the day before, though she had seen plenty of newspaper photographs of her, at race meetings, in Bermuda, or standing by her own plane or car. Yesterday, for the first time, she had seen her in the flesh, and now, as was so often the case,
there was the coincidence of running into her again in a most unlikely place. For somehow, she did not connect lunch at the Army and Navy stores with Bess Sedgwick. She would not have been surprised to see Bess Sedgwick emerging from a den in Soho, or stepping out of Covent Garden Opera House in evening dress with a diamond tiara on her head. But somehow, not in the Army and Navy stores, which in Miss Marple's mind was and always would be connected with the armed forces, their wives, daughters, aunts and grandmothers. Still, there Bess Sedgwick was, looking, as usual, very smart in her dark suit and her emerald shirt, lunching at a table with a man. A young man with a lean, hawk-like face, wearing a black leather jacket. They were leaning forward, talking earnestly together, forking in mouthfuls of food as though they were quite unaware what they were eating. An assignation, perhaps? Yes, probably an assignation. The man must be 15 or 20 years younger than she was, but Bess Sedgwick was a magnetically attractive woman. Miss Marple looked at the young man consideringly and decided that he was what she called a handsome fellow. She also decided that she didn't like him very much. "Just like Harry Russell," said Miss Marple to herself, dredging up a prototype as usual from the past. "Never up to any good. Never did any woman who had anything to do with him any good either. She wouldn't take advice from me," thought Miss Marple, "but I could give her some. However, other people's love affairs were no concern of hers, and Bess Sedgwick, by all accounts, could take care of herself very well when it came to love affairs. Miss Marple sighed, ate her lunch, and meditated a visit to the stationery department. Curiosity, or what she preferred herself to call taking an interest in other people's affairs, was undoubtedly one of Miss Marple's characteristics. Deliberately leaving her gloves on the table, she rose and crossed the floor to the cash desk, taking a route that passed close to Lady Sedgwick's table. Having paid her bill, she discovered the absence of her gloves and returned to get them, unfortunately dropping her handbag on the return route. It came open and spilled various oddments. A waitress rushed to assist her in picking them up, and Miss Marple was forced to show a great shakiness and dropped coppers and keys for a second time. She did not get very much by these subterfuges, but they were not entirely in vain. And it was interesting that neither of the two objects of her curiosity spared as much as a glance for the dithery old lady who kept dropping things. As Miss Marple waited for the lift down, she memorized such scraps as she had heard. "What about the weather forecast? Okay, no fog. All set for Lucerne? Yes. Plane leaves at 9:40. That was all she had got the first time. On the way back, it had lasted a little longer. Bess Sedgwick had been speaking angrily. "What possessed you to come to Bertram's yesterday? You shouldn't have come near the place. It's all right. I asked if you were staying there, and everyone knows we are close friends. That's not the point. Bertram's is all right for me, not for you. You stick out like a sore thumb. Everyone stares at you. Let them. You really are an idiot. Why? Why? What reasons did you have? You had a reason. I know you. Now calm down, Bess. You're such a liar." That was all she had been able to hear. She found it interesting. Chapter 7. On the evening of the 19th of November, Canon Pennyfather had finished an early dinner at the Athenaeum. He had nodded to one or two friends, had had a pleasant, acrimonious discussion on some crucial points of the dating of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and now, glancing at his watch, saw that it was time to leave to catch his plane to Lucerne.
As he passed through the hall, he was greeted by one more friend, Dr. Whittaker of the SOAS, who said cheerfully, "How are you, Pennyfather? Haven't seen you for a long time. How did you get on at the Congress? Any points of interest come up?" "I am sure there will be. Just come back from it, haven't you?"
"No, no, I am on my way there. I'm catching a plane this evening."
"Oh, I see." Whittaker looked slightly puzzled. "Somehow or other, I thought the Congress was today."
"No, no, tomorrow, the 19th.
Canon Pennyfather passed out through the door while his friend, looking after him, was just saying, "But my dear chap, today is the 19th, isn't it?" Canon Pennyfather, however, had gone beyond earshot. He picked up a taxi in Pall Mall and was driven to the air terminal in Kensington. There was quite a fair crowd this evening. Presenting himself at the desk, it at last came to his turn. He managed to produce ticket and passport and other necessities for the journey. The girl behind the desk, about to stamp these credentials, paused abruptly.
"I beg your pardon, sir. This seems to be the wrong ticket."
"The wrong ticket? No, no, that is quite right. Flight 100 and, well, I can't really read without my glasses. 100 and something to Lucerne."
"It's the date, sir. This is dated Wednesday the 18th.
"No, no, surely. At least, I mean, today is Wednesday the 18th.
"I'm sorry, sir. Today is the 19th.
"The 19th? The canon was dismayed. He fished out a small diary, turning the pages eagerly. In the end, he had to be convinced. Today was the 19th. The plane he had meant to catch had gone yesterday.
"Then that means, dear me, it means the Congress at Lucerne has taken place today."
He stared in deep dismay across the counter. But there were many others travelling. The canon and his perplexities were elbowed aside. He stood sadly, holding the useless ticket in his hand. His mind ranged over various possibilities. Perhaps his ticket could be changed, but that would be no use. No, indeed. What time was it now? Going on for 9 o'clock. The conference had actually taken place, starting at 10 o'clock this morning. Of course, that was what Whittaker had meant at the Athenaeum. He thought Canon Pennyfather had already been to the Congress. "Oh, dear, oh, dear," said Canon Pennyfather to himself. "What a muddle I have made of it all." He wandered sadly and silently into the Cromwell Road. Not at its best, a very cheerful place. He walked slowly along the street, carrying his bag and revolving perplexities in his mind. When at last he had worked out to his satisfaction the various reasons for which he had made a mistake in the day, he shook his head sadly.
"Now, I suppose," he said to himself, "I suppose, let me see, it's after 9 o'clock. Yes, I suppose I had better have something to eat."
It was curious, he thought, that he did not feel hungry. Wandering disconsolately along the Cromwell Road, he finally settled upon a small restaurant which served Indian curries. It seemed to him that though he was not quite as hungry as he ought to be, he had better keep his spirits up by having a meal, and after that he must find a hotel and... But there was no need to do that. He had a hotel, of course. He was staying at Bertram's, and had reserved his room for 4 days. What a piece of luck! What a splendid piece of luck! So his room was there, waiting for him. He had only to ask for his key at the desk, and here another reminiscence assailed him. Something heavy in his pocket? He dipped his hand in, and brought out one of those large and solid keys with which hotels try and discourage their vaguer guests from taking away in their pockets. It had not prevented the canon from doing so.
"Number 19, said the canon in happy recognition. "That's right.
It's very fortunate that I haven't got to go and find a room in a hotel. They say they're very crowded just now. Yes, Edmonds was saying so at the Athenaeum this evening. He had a terrible job finding a room. Somewhat pleased with himself and the care he had taken over his travelling arrangements by booking a hotel beforehand, the canon abandoned his curry, remembered to pay for it, and strode out once more into the Cromwell Road. It seemed a little tame to go home just like this when he ought to have been dining in Lucerne and talking about all sorts of interesting and fascinating problems. His eye was caught by a cinema, Walls of Jericho. It seemed an eminently suitable title. It would be interesting to see if biblical accuracy had been preserved. He bought himself a seat and stumbled into the darkness. He enjoyed the film, though it seemed to him to have no relationship to the biblical story whatsoever. Even Joshua seemed to have been left out. The walls of Jericho seemed to be a symbolical way of referring to a certain lady's marriage vows. When they had tumbled down several times, the beautiful star met the dour and uncouth hero whom she had secretly loved all along, and between them they proposed to build up the walls in a way that would stand the test of time better. It was not a film destined particularly to appeal to an elderly clergyman, but Canon Pennefather enjoyed it very much. It was not the sort of film he often saw, and he felt it was enlarging his knowledge of life. The film ended, the lights went up, the national anthem was played, and Canon Pennefather stumbled out into the lights of London, slightly consoled for the sad events of earlier in the evening. It was a fine night, and he walked home to Bertram's hotel after first getting into a bus which took him in the opposite direction. It was midnight when he got in, and Bertram's hotel at midnight usually preserved a decorous appearance of everyone having gone to bed. The lift was on a higher floor, so the canon walked up the stairs. He came to his room, inserted the key in the lock, threw the door open, and entered. Good gracious! Was he seeing things? But who? How? He saw the upraised arm too late. Stars exploded in a kind of Guy Fawkes display within his head. Chapter 8. The Irish mail rushed through the night, or more correctly, through the darkness of the early hours. At intervals, the diesel engine gave its weird banshee warning cry. It was travelling at well over 80 miles an hour. It was on time. Then, with some suddenness, the pace slackened as the brakes came on. The wheels screamed as they gripped the metals. Slower, slower. The guard put his head out of the window, noting the red signal ahead as the train came to a final halt. Some of the passengers woke up. Most did not. One elderly lady, alarmed by the suddenness of the deceleration, opened the door and looked out along the corridor. A little way along, one of the doors to the line was open. An elderly cleric with a thatch of thick white hair was climbing up from the permanent way. She presumed he had previously climbed down to the line to investigate. The morning air was distinctly chilly. Someone at the end of the corridor said, "Only a signal." The elderly lady withdrew into her compartment and tried to go to sleep again. Farther up the line, a man waving a lantern was running towards the train from a signal box. The fireman climbed down from the engine. The guard, who had descended from the train, came along to join him. The man with the lantern arrived, rather short of breath, and spoke in a series of gasps. "Bad crash ahead. Goods train derailed." The engine driver looked out of his cab, then climbed down also to join the others. At the rear of the train, six men who had just climbed up the embankment boarded the train through a door left open for them in the last coach. Six passengers from different coaches met them. With well-rehearsed speed, they proceeded to take charge of the postal van, isolating it from the rest of the train.
Two men in balaclava helmets at front and rear of the compartment stood on guard, koshes in hand. A man in railway uniform went forward along the corridor of the stationary train, uttering explanations to such as demanded them.
Block on the line ahead. 10 minutes delay, maybe. Not much more.
It sounded friendly and reassuring. By the engine, the driver and the fireman lay neatly gagged and trussed up. The man with the lantern called out,
"Everything okay here?"
The guard lay by the embankment, similarly gagged and tied. The expert cracksmen in the postal van had done their work. Two more neatly trussed bodies lay on the floor. The special mailbag sailed out to where other men on the embankment awaited them. In their compartments, passengers grumbled to each other that the railways were not what they used to be. Then, as they settled themselves to sleep again, there came through the darkness the roar of an exhaust.
"Goodness," murmured a woman. "Is that a jet plane?"
"Racing car, I should say."
The roar died away. On the Bedhampton motorway, 9 miles away, a steady stream of night lorries was grinding its way north. A big white racing car flashed past them. 10 minutes later, it turned off the motorway. The garage on the corner of the B road bore the sign "closed," but the big doors swung open and the white car was driven straight in, the doors closing again behind it. 3 men worked at lightning speed. A fresh set of number plates were attached. The driver changed his coat and cap. He had worn white sheepskin before. Now he wore black leather. He drove out again. 3 minutes after his departure, an old Morris Oxford, driven by a clergyman, chugged out onto the road and proceeded to take a route through various turning and twisting country lanes. A station wagon, driven along a country road, slowed up as it came upon an old Morris Oxford stationary by the hedge, with an elderly man standing over it. The driver of the station wagon put out a head.
"I'm in trouble. Can I help?" "Very good of you. It's my lights."
The two drivers approached each other, listened. "All clear." Various expensive American-style cases were transferred from the Morris Oxford to the station wagon. A mile or two farther on, the station wagon turned off on what looked like a rough track, but which presently turned out to be the way to a large and opulent mansion. In what had been the stable yard, a big white Mercedes car was standing. The driver of the station wagon opened its boot with a key, transferred the cases to the boot, and drove away again in the station wagon. In a nearby farmyard, a cock crowed noisily. Chapter 9. Elvira Blake looked up at the sky, noted that it was a fine morning, and went into a telephone box. She dialed Bridget's number in Onslow Square. Satisfied by the response, she said, "Hello, Bridget."
"Oh, Elvira, is that you?"
Bridget's voice sounded agitated.
"Yes. Has everything been all right?" "Oh, no, it's been awful. Your cousin, Mrs. Melford, rang up Mummy yesterday afternoon."
"What, about me?"
"Yes. I thought I'd done it so well when I rang her up at lunchtime, but it seems she got worried about your teeth. Thought there might be something really wrong with them, abscesses or something. So she rang up the dentist herself and found, of course, that you'd never been there at all. So then she rang up Mummy, and unfortunately Mummy was right there by the telephone, so I couldn't get there first. And naturally Mummy said she didn't know anything about it, and that you certainly weren't staying here. I didn't know what to do."
"What did you do?"
"Pretended I knew nothing about it. I did say that I thought you'd said something about going to see some friends at Wimbledon."
"Why Wimbledon?"
"It was the first place that came into my head."
Elvira sighed. "Oh, well, I suppose I'll have to cook up something. An old governess, perhaps, who lives at Wimbledon. All this fussing does make things so complicated. I hope Cousin Mildred doesn't make a real fool of herself and ring up the police or something like that. You got to Ireland, was it? All right?"
"I found out what I wanted to know."
"You sound sort of grim."
"I'm feeling grim." Can't I help you, Elvira? Do anything?
Nobody can help me, really. It's a thing I have to do myself. I hoped something wasn't true, but it is true. I don't know quite what to do about it.
Are you in danger, Elvira?
Don't be melodramatic, Bridget. I'll have to be careful, that's all. I'll have to be very careful.
Then you are in danger.
Elvira said after a moment's pause, I expect I'm just imagining things, that's all.
Elvira, what are you going to do about that bracelet?
Oh, that's all right. I've arranged to get some money from someone so I can go and, what's the word, redeem it. Then just take it back to Bollard's.
Do you think they'll be all right about it?
No, Mummy. It's just the laundry. They say we never sent that cheat. Yes, Mummy. Yes, I'll tell the manageress. All right, then. At the other end of the line, Elvira grinned and put down the receiver. She opened her purse, sorted through her money, counted out the coins she needed, and arranged them in front of her, and proceeded to put through a call. When she got the number she wanted, she put in the necessary coins, pressed button A, and spoke in a small, rather breathless voice.
Hello, Cousin Mildred.
Yes, it's me.
I'm terribly sorry. Yes, I know. Well, I was going to. Yes, it was dear old Maddie, you know, our old mademoiselle. Yes, I wrote a postcard, then I forgot to post it. It's still in my pocket now. Well, you see, she was ill, and there was no one to look after her, so I just stopped to see she was all right. Yes, I was going to Bridget, but this changed things. I don't understand about the message you got. Someone must have jumbled it up. Yes, I'll explain it all to you when I get back. Yes, this afternoon. No, I shall just wait and see the nurse who's coming to look after old Maddie. Well, not really a nurse, you know, one of those, practical aid nurses or something like that. No, she would hate to go to hospital. But I am sorry, Cousin Mildred. I really am very, very sorry. She put down the receiver and sighed in an exasperated manner. If only, she murmured to herself, one didn't have to tell so many lies to everybody. She came out of the telephone box, noting as she did so the big newspaper placards. Big train robbery. Irish male attacked by bandits. Mr. Bollard was serving a customer when the shop door opened. He looked up to see the Honourable Elvira Blake entering. No, she said to an assistant who came forward to her. I'd rather wait until Mr. Bollard is free. Presently, Mr. Bollard's customer's business was concluded, and Elvira moved into the vacant place. Good morning, Mr. Bollard, she said.
I am afraid your watch isn't done quite as soon as this, Miss Elvira, said Mr. Bollard.
Oh, it's not the watch, said Elvira. I've come to apologize. A dreadful thing happened. She opened her bag and took out a small box. From it she extracted the sapphire and diamond bracelet. You will remember when I came in with my watch to be repaired that I was looking at things for a Christmas present, and there was an accident outside in the street. Somebody was run over, I think, or nearly run over. I suppose I must have had the bracelet in my hand and put it into the pocket of my suit without thinking, although I only found it this morning. So I rushed along at once to bring it back. I'm so terribly sorry, Mr. Bollard. I don't know how I came to do such an idiotic thing.
Why, that's quite all right, Miss Elvira, said Mr. Bollard slowly.
I suppose you thought someone had stolen it, said Elvira. Her limpid blue eyes met his.
We had discovered its loss, said Mr. Bollard. Thank you very much, Miss Elvira, for bringing it back so promptly.
I felt simply awful about it when I found it, said Elvira. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Bollard, for being so nice about it.
A lot of strange mistakes do occur, said Mr. Bollard. He smiled at her in an avuncular manner. We won't think of it any more. But don't do it again, though.
He laughed with the air of one making a genial little joke. Oh, no, said Elvira. I shall be terribly careful in future. She smiled at him, turned, and left the shop.
Now I wonder, said Mr. Bollard to himself. I really do wonder.
One of his partners, who had been standing near, moved nearer to him.
So she did take it, he said. Yes, she took it all right, said Mr. Bollard.
But she brought it back, his partner pointed out.
She brought it back, agreed Mr. Bollard. I didn't actually expect that.
You mean you didn't expect her to bring it back?
No, not if it was she who'd taken it.
Do you think her story is true? His partner inquired curiously. I mean that she slipped it into her pocket by accident.
I suppose it's possible, said Bollard thoughtfully.
Or it could be kleptomania, I suppose.
Or it could be kleptomania, agreed Bollard. It's more likely that she took it on purpose. But if so, why did she bring it back so soon? It's curious.
Just as well we didn't notify the police. I admit I wanted to.
I know. You haven't got as much experience as I have. In this case, it was definitely better not.
He added softly to himself, The thing's interesting, though. Quite interesting.
I wonder how old she is. 17 or 18, I suppose. She might have got herself in a jam of some kind.
I thought you said she was rolling in money.
You may be an heiress and rolling in money, said Mr. Bollard, but at 17 you can't always get your hands on it. The funny thing is, you know, they keep heiresses much shorter of cash than they keep the more impecunious. It's not always a good idea. Well, I don't suppose we shall ever know the truth of it.
He put the bracelet back in its place in the display case and shut down the lid.
End of disc 2.